I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Happiness!
It's something we all want, but it often seems like finding it is something we each have to do on our own. We aren't guaranteed happiness. It's not a human right. And it's not the government's job to measure and improve the happiness of its citizen. That is, unless you happen to live in Bhutan.
This week on Pot of Gold, we're speaking with Dasho Karma Ura, president of the Center for Bhutan Studies on Gross National Happiness. Rather than focusing on just gross domestic product as the measure of a successful government, Bhutan has spent the last several decades studying ways to maximize the happiness of the people that live there. We ask about the key findings and the direction we need to go as a society to bring us all more happiness. Here's Karma.
I am Karma Ura. I am at this moment talking from capital of Kingdom of Bhutan in the Himalayas. The town is known as Thimphu, and it has about 150,000 people. This is the biggest city in this country of 700,000 people. I have been working for the last 20 years now in the research center of the government called Center for Bhutan and Gross National Happiness Studies. And its function is to conduct surveys in Bhutan in order to generate information or data on happiness and well-being and feed the government relevant information that would lead them to change policies. That's our major task in the institution.
So it was quite a while ago when I think it was the king of Bhutan who decided, or who thought the gross national happiness is more important than the gross domestic product. And he coined that phrase, gross happiness index, right? GNH, Gross National Happiness Index. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of the Gross National Happiness Index?
To give you a brief background about the Gross National Happiness Index, the concept and its application to government policy was started by the fourth king of Bhutan, who ruled Bhutan from 1972 to 2006. So at the moment, our king, His Majesty, is the fifth king of Bhutan, but the Gross National Happiness was started by the fourth king of Bhutan in 70s. As you know, the world then was very different. The focus was very much on industrialization, economic growth, resolution of poverty, and so on and so forth. But at that time, the idea that the well-being and happiness ought to be the leading guide in socio-economic development of a country was fairly new. In Canada and US, there were researchers interested in this field, but it was not widespread amongst the governments. So Bhutan was, due to the sort of foresight of the King of Bhutan, a bit early to take that path. And that happened because of the thought and culture which were influenced by Buddhism. As you know, Buddhism considers the preference or the search in individual life for peace, calmness, and happiness a little more seriously than maybe other beliefs. So that is why it was quite natural for the fifth fourth king of Bhutan, to build on this ancient framework that human beings, indeed all sentient beings, not only human beings, all creatures which have feelings and life, wish constantly for well-being. So to take that thought into account in governance and in modernization was quite foresightful, quite bold also in a way, because 70s, 80s, and still now, we have a huge community of economists, technicians, industrialists, politicians who believe only in economic progress as measured by gross national happiness. So that is how it started in Bhutan.
And so now it's been 50 years, almost 50 years since this began, and you've been studying this idea of measuring happiness for 20 of those years. How's it been going? What have you discovered?
It's been a experience with steady progress in this country. It has provoked a great deal of curiosity around the world, as you know. The difference is that earlier, the concepts and ideas of gross national happiness were highly internalized as value amongst leaders. And so it got translated most of the time, not always, most of the time into government policies and legislations. Then as time went on, development and modernization also became very technocratic, with a lot of Bhutanese and foreigners who brought ideas from the West to Bhutan. And that means the frameworks of planning in terms of macroeconomy, industry, health, education, and so forth. Just like in any other developing country. That means, of course, that there was a danger or a chance that they would gradually seep in and overcome cross-national happiness also. So we had to, under the leadership of the fifth king of Bhutan, that is since 2006, we had to rapidly decide, evolve a quantitative framework, exactly like GDP or macroeconomic planning. As you know, as soon as you have big organizations, any ministry, any corporation, there are managers and executives, and they stay in one position and move on, you know, like dances, one place to another, one site to another. And for such mobile, intransigent bureaucrats, we need managerial tools. We need measurement targets. Mm-hmm. We need lots of statistics to show them the evidences on well-being. So we went to do surveys, generate data, construct indicators, and supply them to the plannings and policy divisions of various ministries. And now, under the reign of the fifth king of Bhutan and democratic government, we have also elected parties running the country, by the way, and they change every 5 years, just like what you are subjected to you today and yesterday. And some of the promising politicians may come with ideas very different from gross national happiness. So, but we need to embed them quickly through indicators, gross national happiness, targets in numbers, presented in numbers, So now it is not only a value system, but it is also a quantitative framework, where numbers play some role.
Have you found these the metrics actually have now a stronger impact when you measure it on the actual happiness of the population? Are Bhutanese more happy than the rest of the world?
Yes. No. Bhutanese, we do not exactly have one yardstick that measures happiness and well-being all over the world. Just now, we don't have one. The one which you may have come across, and which the work of the subjective well-being people who rely on Gallup data, your US-based company, supposedly collecting information on subjective well-being. Are you, how happy are you in your life, rate from 0 to 10? That simple question. They claim they run surveys all over the world and supply the data to this group, and they produce a ranking. First of all, I am yet to be fully convinced that they conduct good surveys or surveys at all in Bhutan. I've never heard, but they say they have surveyed 1,000 respondents from this country. And when I asked them, how did you do it? They say they did it by internet, telephone call. You know, a lot of Bhutanese people don't speak English also. So how they conducted this electronic interview, I wonder. Anyway, there is one ranking in according to that, Bhutan is rated or ranked in 93rd position in the world. 93rd, according to that. But I would like to say that I am very skeptical about their numbers and their that ranks they produce, partly because I think their sample is not representative. I don't know whether the survey really took place or not. So we should bear in mind, because a lot of listeners get confused. Oh, you are supposed to be happiest country, but your rank is 93 in the world. Number one is some Scandinavian country, you know, some nation. And I'm doubtful whether that really portrays the reality in the world. Also, the measurement based on one single question item done by Gallup might not be able to read the phenomena such as happiness with a single question.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I know that the metrics you have is quite robust, right? It's a whole book of robust metrics for measuring happiness. And I'd like to explore a little bit how this system would contrast with the way we traditionally in the West measure success, right? We measure success usually by wealth, financial wealth. You know, we compare ourselves in a financial way, and oftentimes it doesn't include many of the other factors you're talking about. Could you speak a little bit to the way this set of metrics that you've developed is more accurate in defining a life well lived, so to speak, or better for society? Like, how do you see it shaping the way we live as human beings?
As we live in a market society, some amount of money, as you know, should be counted as a component contributing towards happiness. But I think we should not go all the way towards materialism, where we believe that money is a complete reflection of happiness, and that more money is monotonically or exclusively related to higher happiness. I mean, both of these statements would be considered false by most people, I think. If we check any causal studies of well-being and happiness, we would find that money cannot be taken as the end. It is simply a means, but it is a means towards certain things that may also be obtained without money, but that depends on the configuration and structure of society, of course. If everything is sold only in market, and if it is the only way to get it, of course, then money would play such a dominant role. But we find that at this stage in development in Bhutan, we find that money is not overwhelming explanatory factor for happiness at all. What we do find here is independently, as an independent factor, you find psychological well-being, extremely powerful explanatory factor for happiness. Now, psychological well-being means positive emotions and minimization of negative emotions. And the training for cultivation of positive emotions like calmness, generosity, joyfulness, etc., is not completely associated with high per capita income. Also, we find that the nature of human relationship, which is not always mediated by money, in fact, if it is not mediated money, if it is off the market, away from market, it would be better actually. So the quality and the depth of relationship within the household and between the household is an extremely decisive factor in making the members happy. So the reciprocal relationship, warmth and frequency of relationship, and the unstressed provision of time, social support, and emotional support amongst the members of community is really another measure of happiness amongst human beings. In fact, psychological well-being, community vitality, and access to environment and good health, these are the true mirrors of happiness, not financial success. Not financial success. If you want to hold up whether individuals are happy or not, you check these things first.
I think we couldn't agree more. Karma, the one thing is to measure it all and to know what is the composition and the dimensions of happiness. But the other thing is how to implement it or how to create it within the community, or as you just said, within the household, within the individual, within the house, or within the community, within the country, and then ultimately within the world.
Actually, it is now only in modern times where implementation has become ironically challenging, because the instruments in the hand of government, which invest money that is collected from us as taxes, the instrument itself is money, you see. They think this is the major thing in their hand, really, besides the legislation. They said legislations. So if you look at the structure of the government in the world today, strangely, it is also mirror image of GDP, agriculture, fisheries, electricity, banking, transport, etc., you see. So the organizations which have been created serve to develop this kind of sectors. Of course, I can add there is a security, judiciary, and so on and so forth, you know. So government is very good at providing infrastructure, public goods, security, agricultural growth, electricity growth, transport expansion, so on and so forth. So this is the focus in the modern times. But for most of the times in history, government didn't collect that much money, and money was not the only instrument in their hand, and not the only idea of the function of the state was to grow economy. So they could do things without financial means. Why can't modern government with so much power and complex knowledge do also, you know? And the perspective just now is that happiness is to be obtained, resolved, or mobilized within your own household privately. Government will provide infrastructure. So we are left to sort out this fundamental public good, which we call happiness, on our own, as an individual search and quest. While government is focused on delivery of material goods, so-called materialism, that is income growth, through solving unemployment and so on and so forth. So we have reached a very contradictory situation where individuals' goal is well-being and happiness, and we are to define, conceive, and search for this within our own helpless life, within the small confines of our own family and relatives. And government is not so much concerned with it, but government is concerned with infrastructure provision and security, justice, and so on and so forth, you know. Where these two paths can now converge is our task.
And how do you see that converging? What kind of government do you envision that would maximize happiness?
Now, the interestingly, in the last 10 years, we see lots of stirring and lots of bubbles, you know, coming up from below. So, for the first time, and the literature on happiness and well-being is growing, scrutinizing economic growth. Also, it is naturally coming into question because of climate change, inequality, poverty, etc., you know, in the era of plenty in the world, era of surplus, era of extreme ability to produce mass destruction weapons, all sort of technological capabilities are there, but not directed towards solving fundamental issues. So, as I said, there are new turning points and stirrings in the last 10 years itself. We have seen tremendous focus on mental health. Of course, mental health is the breakdown or disruption of happiness at a clinical level. But a lot of people are unhappy without being clinical candidates, you know. So mental health, the attention on mental health is suggesting that people want to know and explore more about well-being. The appointment of cabinet-level individuals to forge a path towards well-being has also taken place in several countries. I think in the United States, places like Vermont have gone little ahead, thinking your constitution's declaration seriously. In UK also, there has been appointment of Minister of Loneliness, I think. Yeah? Not happiness, Minister of Loneliness. So that institutional changes are taking place. And the challenge against orthodox economics is quite strong now, very, very strong. Heterodox economics, behavioral economics, all challenging the assumptions of human beings as selfish, human beings as sort of intoxicated consumer, you know, stripping the earth, writing other human being into slavish position, etc. So that's also a new thing. I think the convergence is very natural. Mm. In my opinion, it's very natural. Only we had a long 200-300 years of aberrations.
So you sound very hopeful. Like, do you imagine that as the idea of gross national happiness takes hold in the world, things like climate change will be reversed more quickly? I mean, is there a practical global impact?
Definitely. You know, in 20 years practice of gross national happiness in our country, we have seen unexpected number of allies grow around the world. There is, as you say, spontaneous awareness that somebody has misled us. Anyway, my main point to your question is that we cannot seek, even at a global level, happiness as we have been done in the past through high energy consumption, through high pollution, through ineffective consumption, by the way. Consumption which doesn't translate into well-being and happiness. This is a wrong design somewhere. So people now, voluntarily now, giving up so much sensory input.
Now, something just sparked when you talked about it, because it seems almost like a contradiction to me. You know, we are worldwide on a brink of losing our natural diversity. It's a not just a climate chaos and a disaster we are moving into. We are really losing nature. And with that, we are losing our connection to nature.
Yes, yes.
How can we possibly find happiness without this connection to nature, with losing our diversity and ecological environment?
Yes, you mentioned connection to nature. Nature as a service provider or economic service provider is well known, but less emphasized, I'm glad you brought this up, is that human beings also need to consume the colors, vibrancy, and freshness of nature. On a daily basis, all human beings have right to that source of happiness. And most of them, fortunately, peasants have. They compensate other absence by access to nature in their daily life. As they cast a glance out of their window to see a thousand of trees on the slope of a mountain. It's a pure bliss, pure bliss. Or to dissolve their stress and tension as they walk back from their day of work out in the open through a forest, crossing a stream, which they hear and see. It's a pure pleasure, pure pleasure for the day, really. So, we need this closeness, I mean to say. Not only we need the stock of nature as wealth, but we need also this daily connection and contact. We need to feel this vibrancy of nature.
For me, it sounds like the idea of well-being is more about connectedness, whereas market economy, orthodox economics is more about disconnectedness. Does that resonate for you? Like this idea of interdependence being more central to our thinking?
Definitely. In some sense, happiness and well-being is neither yours nor mine, actually. It always arises at the moment of interconnectedness. Whether it is between two human beings or whether it is being between a person and the vision of a great clean river. When you see that, at that moment of interconnection, the spark arises in your heart. So it is truly like that. But what it means is also for that moment, your own hardened idea of your individuality is forgotten. So sometimes interdependence, enjoyment of interdependence and interconnection requires dissolution of self. So this immersion in the community, in the togetherness, or in nature, this is a moment of joy. And we may not be able to be drunk and joyful throughout the day, but if we can feel that every few days once, we can go ahead with our struggles.
I wonder if if you would like to say something which is really close to your heart about the subject of gross national happiness, or something we haven't maybe touched on, which we'd really like to share with our listeners.
I think this kind of architecture about gross national happiness is a bit too tedious for people, you know, with metrics, statistics, surveys, and all sort of instruments and targets. But what I might like to share is that all of us have to carry on our life with great size, you know, things going wrong, accidents, mortality around, misfortunes, suppressions, you know, lost years in many people's life. In the midst of this, we have to always carry on. And to do that, I would like to say that on a daily basis, we need to do three things, okay? One thing is we have to recover ourselves, our body and mind, and all of us must strive to create a space for 1 hour of meditation, along with a very tough breathing exercise. This should be combined, otherwise it's not effective. Second thing is I would like people to connect with nature in order to regenerate nature. Otherwise, you will not feel the value of it. So take a walk for 1 hour, if it is possible. Otherwise, 30 minutes through forests, across streams, or by the banks of rivers, or on the ridges of misty mountains, wherever you are, you happen to be. So this is very important, because otherwise you will see it only as an external, distant object, not related to you. You know, it must be part of your landscape of your mind. It must be part of your landscape. The third thing, I think, it's a very somewhat paternalistic for me to say, but I think the importance of healthy eating, I think we need to emphasize. Only with healthy eating, healthy nature, healthy cycle of food going into us, we can be happy and healthy and you know, enjoy both at the same time. So the production system behind food must be everybody's concern. And eventually what comes two times a day in front of you, you have to be extremely discerning, you know, and eat mindfully too, very mindfully, and drink water very mindfully, you know. Then we must every day for about an hour think of others, do things for others. Otherwise, we will harden up into ourselves, into demonic, selfish people. So that also requires discipline. Daily discipline. And if you have done these three things already, I think you will be able to sleep. And we need that good, deep, uninterrupted, dreamful 7 or 8 hours without noise, without pollution, without anybody depriving us, because we need to forget ourselves from the samsara every day.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Karma. It's been wonderful to talk about
happiness.
Happiness.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know how much I love misty mountains and wavy oceans, but I particularly liked the part.
I knew that was going to spark your interest.
No, it was beautiful how you described his environment and the recipe to having a happy life, I was particularly intrigued in. And it's been now a couple of weeks we interviewed him, right? And so I actually tried to follow his advice, these five steps.
Is that why you've been so happy?
Very funny. But, let's just talk a little bit about this,
sure.
Right? So the it was meditation. He recommended meditation.
1 hour of meditation.
Was it an hour?
Mm-hmm. 1 hour of meditation.
I don't do an hour, but anyways, meditation, walk in nature.
1 hour of walking in nature.
I definitely increased the time in the park, mm-hmm. which is nature for us. I mean, which is nature for a lot of people who live in urban cities. So that's as mm-hmm. good as it gets, and the dog really enjoys it.
1 hour of thinking about others.
Yeah, I guess that can be increased. Eating well, we
yes.
try getting good food and taking the time for cooking. And that really works well,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it? I mean,
yep.
now
no,
it's the time to say yes. But and sleeping well, I mean, that also has increased for me. And it does really improve, I think, your daily happiness.
No, I think it's, you know, it's a really great recipe, right, for happiness. You know, I think the way to think about this is how does anyone in modern life have the time to do this? And, you know, this is actually, I think, one of the core questions we're trying to get at is, what if we had a basic income? Or what if we didn't have to scramble and compete to win enough money to support ourselves? And we had time to think about others, really, and to commute with nature and even nourish nature back.
Right, and to get out of that machine of a 9-to-5 job and then come home and like squeeze in the time with your kids before they go to bed and like do this and this and this and this and
mm-hmm.
then train your body and, you know, get fit. And I don't know what else is on the list of how I have a successful life in modern times.
But that's the question. Success in Western culture is not necessarily happy. And I think what he distinguishes here is so great, you know, the difference between what is success, what is happiness, and our big question, what is wealth?
You can see it in all these advertisements, what makes you happy, 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 happy. And then in the end, you buy the product and it doesn't really make you more happy. And I guess this is something I think we are discovering in, let's say, capitalistic world more and more, that these products, it's really not really making us more happy. And actually the pandemic, I have the feeling it is getting a little bit to the core, you know, of people, where maybe discovering the time and maybe being forced to spend time with yourself is also quite a big challenge for a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
including myself, to be honest.
And with nature, I think, I mean, also, you know, like, buying anything doesn't even make his list. You know, trade doesn't make his list. It's not even part of the recipe for happiness. Yet we spend a lot of our time buying stuff and thinking about buying stuff and working to buy stuff. And, you know, you're right. I think the pandemic has put us in a new
paradigm.
Probably
connected to some kind of hormones, you know, which are released when you buy stuff and then it makes you happy for a little amount of time. It's exactly the same as eating too much sugar. And we know how much sugar is in the American diet. Yeah, but it is not very long lasting. It's not enduring. It's not the real happiness comes from inside. And so what we much appreciate about Karma's five very simple points to happiness. It doesn't include sugar and it doesn't include buying more products.
I guess that's karma.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.